Dr. Hall, you said you became interested in chemistry as early as the fourth grade, and that intrigued me.
Or science, mm-hmm. in general.
Did you have a natural curiosity bent about what was going on in the world?
Had a natural bent that way, and I would go to the library and bring home books on science. It just happened. Mm-hmm. I can't explain it, but it's just the way it went.
Did you ever conduct any unsuccessful experiments as a child?
Well, yeah, of all kinds, mechanical or chemical, mm-hmm. or electrical, I was fascinated a lot by electricity.
Now, when did you move toward the field that you eventually moved in? Was that as you went in high school and up beyond?
Well, yes. In high school, I would take all the science that was offered and all the math. So I'd take chemistry and physics, just because I liked it all. Mm-hmm. Then when I went to college, I went to Weber College first 2 years and looked at the courses. I saw that the engineering or the pre-engineering courses had the most science. Mm-hmm. That is, we could take geology and chemistry and physics and math and surveying, anything connected with science. I took it all that they had to offer. And then when I went to the University of Utah and wanted to decide on which branch of engineering to go in, I found out they didn't have much. And so since they all interested me, I majored in chemistry and minored in physics.
Mm-hmm. Then you went to, you say initially, GE wasn't too interested in hiring you, but you were rather persistent, I understand.
Well, that's true. You probably read that I told my fourth grade teacher a long time ago that mm-hmm. she was surveying the class, you know, what mm-hmm. you're going to be when you grow up. And I told her I was going to be a scientist and work for General Electric Company. Now, that came about because the General Electric Company was an outgrowth of Edison and his activities. And he was one of my early heroes that I'd read about in the science books I'd bring home from the Ogden City Public Library.
He was a fascinating man himself. One of my favorite stories is about how much that man did. I guess it'd take volumes just to fill the patents, I guess, that he did have. I think everybody thinks in terms of Edison as the electric light, but certainly he did more than that.
He was in chemistry a great deal, too, and you don't usually hear of that.
No, you don't.
Have you been in his lab at Orange, New Jersey?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, a great part of that lab is chemistry laboratory. Mm-hmm. And a tremendous machine shop. Machine shops fascinate me, and he has a really tremendous machine shop, something built, you know, before the mm-hmm. turn of the century. He could make anything he wanted because he had the facilities there to do it.
He really had an inquiring mind, didn't he? I guess there isn't a facet of science probably that he didn't at least look into at one point in his life.
Well, that's true. He was a very practical man. There are many of our modern-day scientists that wouldn't call him a scientist. They'd say he's an inventor. Mm-hmm. We have a sort of a peck order that's developed in science, you know, mathematicians on top, then physicists, then chemists, and so on. Really doesn't mean anything, but there has been a tendency, I believe, too much of a tendency to develop ivory tower mm-hmm. type of scientists in our country. Physicists and chemists and others have sort of held a disdain for the type of activity that Edison would be engaged in.
You feel then that the true scientist is not only a thinker, he's a doer as well.
Well, yes, and the pendulum is swinging back that way. We've become very highly specialized in this country. A man is a very particular kind of physicist or a very particular kind of chemist. And some feel that the generalist, the scientific generalist, is passé because he can't master all the disciplines. Mm-hmm. Well, it's true he can't master them in detail, but I think it would be better if we would cross the scientific disciplines more than we do. In fact, when students come to me for advice and say I'm going to be a chemist, I tell them, take physics as much as you can work in, and take math as much as you can work in. I think, I probably shouldn't say this here at BYU, you know, without clearing with the proper people, but I have long felt that we have physicists who major in one branch of physics and minor in another, take the one little elementary course required in chemistry. And the same thing happens to chemists. They take the one little elementary course required in physics, and they major in some branch of chemistry and minor in another branch. It's easier that way, but I think that those who have a goal, you know, to have a broader outlook at the whole thing ought to take all the science, physics, math, and nowadays biological science, and chemistry that they can work in, and geology.
Do you feel that the coursework that you took like that at Weber College and whatnot helped you later?
You bet. I had an awful lot to make up because the engineers, you see, were excused from some branches of English I had to make up, and I had to go take a language and history and some social courses and whatnot. I was a year behind, as a matter of fact.
You mean when you got to the U?
When I got to the University of Utah. Mm-hmm. Now, it was all right, but it really did put me under pressure to pick all that stuff up and get through in the 4 years, which I did succeed in doing.
But you specialized more at the U then? Than you had at Weber.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Hall, moving to your experience with GE, and of course your name is indelibly associated with diamonds, how did you get into the experimenting and the search for man-made diamonds? How did that begin?
Well, it began before General Electric. I had, as many young men do, read about diamonds before I ever went there and the attempts to synthesize them by various people. And during my master's year at the University of Utah, I worked on that problem part of the time. Didn't have any high pressure machines or any way to generate high pressure, but I thought about the problem and tried to do experiments at room temperature and pressure. Now, on going to General Electric, I went in 48. In 51, the management there decided to work on that problem specifically. And they called in the chemists, about 30 of them, and they asked for volunteers to work on this project. Well, I was immediately volunteered because of my prior interest. No one else volunteered, so there's no competition for the job, and I got it.
The other 29 probably said, aha, he's walked into it.
Well, yes. There have been a total of 5 men in science who have obtained Nobel Prizes who have worked on that problem. And they succeeded in getting the Nobel Prizes for other things, but they never succeeded in making diamonds. And it was the oldest unsolved problem in science. Men had been trying for about 175 years to make diamond before it was finally made. And you knew it was a long shot. It was just a small, very small probability that you would succeed from past experience.
Dr. Hall, let me ask you this. From a layman's point of view, why was there that pressure, in a sense, the research pressure to find this? You know, we hear that there are natural diamonds in relative abundance. Why the urge for the synthesized diamond?
Well, the scientific challenge is certainly a big motivating force. And the other one is economic. You see, the graphite, like in your lead pencil, is the starting material for diamond. It's worth maybe 25 cents a pound in its cheapest form. But diamonds, such as that diamond grit that you have in your the little grains of sand kind of stuff, that's worth $6,000 a pound. Well, that's quite an incentive, don't you think, to go from something that costs 25 cents to something worth $6,000?
So then the incentive was not only just the challenge, but an economic a necessity, perhaps.
Right. As it has turned out, you see, the man-made materials are superior to natural materials in many important respects. And the people who have been in the diamond mining business are now also in the diamond making business. You have to compete. That man-made grit, in many applications, performs 200 times as well as the natural man-made or the natural grit. Mm-hmm. The natural grit comes from crushing bad stones that can't be used for gems or large industrial stones. You just crush it to get the grit, grain of salt kind of material. Whereas you grow it sort of to the size you want in the man-made process.
Well, returning to your volunteering as the single person, what happened after that?
Well, actually, the first two men on the project were physicists. And they just thought they ought to have a couple of physicists and a couple of chemists. The management wanted to do that. So a year later, they obtained another chemist by hiring one, since none of the ones already in the GE Research Lab in Schenectady wanted to work on it. So during the course of the next few years, from 1951 through 1955, there were two physicists and two chemists working on this project. It seemed to break down into two natural aspects. There was the job of trying to make high-pressure machines to generate pressures and temperatures at the same time that man had never seen before. And then there was the chemical problem of just how are you going to, what are you going to do to that graphite to make it turn into the diamond? And maybe you don't want to start with graphite. Maybe just some carbon-containing compound such as calcium carbonate. So there was a physical or engineering problem of developing equipment, and there was a chemical problem of just how are you going to go about this if you do have some pressures and temperatures. There were some hints from nature that pressure and temperature was required, and by 1932 there was enough theoretical knowledge around concerning chemistry and physics that you could pretty well predict that you would have to have pressure and temperature. You didn't know how much pressure and temperature, but you knew it would take some.
So those were really the two unknown quantities, in a sense. Well, and you also suggest that you weren't sure what material to start with.
That's right.
So those were the three unknowns, as it were?
You might say there are three basic unknowns, but actually there were a lot more than that. it was a complexity of many unknowns, because each variable could be varied over a whole range of unknowns. And so you had all the combinations of a half a dozen things, which in themselves had combinations of intrinsic to each variable. So it's one of those things where you apply the best science you know, and then just hope that you just experiment, trial and error. You have hunches. Sometimes your hunches are lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there a question about whether to use a catalyst or not?
Yes, that's true. Of course, all you had to go on were the diamond did exist in nature, and we still don't know how the diamonds were formed in the pipe mines in South Africa, for example. It's a very complex geological system, a very mixed up system. The pipes where the diamonds are found, not just one kind of rock. It's a mixture of hundreds of varieties of rock that seems to have been in some kind of turmoil. And of course, you'd look at that rock and say, well, could diamond have come from this? Could diamond have come from that? It's an unsolved problem to this day. But there was another source of diamond on Earth, an extraterrestrial source, diamonds from meteorites. And that's where the inspiration finally came from. On reading about the three cases out of the thousands of known meteorites on the Earth, three back in 1954 were known to contain microscopic diamonds. And on reading that literature, I found each diamond had a film around it of a mineral called troilite. It's an iron sulfide mineral. And I got the idea of putting that in with the graphite, and fortunately had the pressure and temperature the right place on that day, and that material turned the trick, and it proved to be what a chemist would call a catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
You may have the right pressure and temperature and ingredients, except for the catalyst, and have what a chemist would say is thermodynamic permission for this reaction to go, but it might take a million years to do it, and you can't wait for that. So you search for a catalyst, which is something that will speed up a reaction. And the iron sulfide proved to be a catalyst, and then I found out that the iron and the iron sulfide would do it. And knowing that, then you could quickly try all the metals around iron in the periodic table, and some 13 of them were found to act as catalysts. So we think that the diamonds in these meteorites are made by the pressure and temperature generated on the impact. Just milliseconds, perhaps, just fractions of a second. The meteor hits the Earth, so there's a high temperature and a high pressure at impact. And in that brief period of time, you can make microscopic diamonds. As a matter of fact, this has been carried now forward by other people, and diamonds have been made by explosive means. Not as large as nature has made them. It's fine stuff like face powder. And you can buy that kind of material nowadays. It's on the market. It has a limited use because it's so extremely fine.
Mm-hmm.
But you can generate an instantaneous pressure just by an explosion.
Is that a cheaper process than saying?
Probably. Probably.
From the time you started till the discovery was, or the answer, I should say, was approximately 3 years.
Then. About 3 years.
Do you have any idea how many times, how many different experiments you went through in that period?
Well, I never counted them, but it was hundreds.
Did you ever become frustrated and think that maybe you were pursuing a ghost?
Oh, yes. Yes, you bet. You see, the theoretical people who had studied the problem had concluded that it would take about 35,000 atmospheres. An atmosphere is the pressure of the air on our bodies, about 15 pounds per square inch. What's 15 times 35, John? Somewhere around, get out my calculator, 400,000 PSI up in that neighborhood, pounds per square inch. Would be required, and perhaps a temperature of 1,000 degrees centigrade. And most scientists in the world thought if somebody could build a high-pressure machine that would achieve those conditions, that you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the belt apparatus that I invented at General Electric Company achieved conditions that I thought at the time were 200,000 atmospheres, almost six times as high as what scientists thought. Well, I was in new unexplored territory, and I had to estimate these pressures by various schemes. Now that 20 years has gone by and we know better how to deal with those pressures, we know that I was only at 140,000 atmospheres. But you see, that was still four times as high. And I could get temperatures way beyond 1,000 degrees. For brief periods, we had temperatures estimated as hot as 7,000 degrees centigrade. 2,000 degrees centigrade was easy. And the graphite alone was not transforming under those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And the company in early December of 1954 was essentially ready to abandon the project because people had always thought that it was the equipment that was the bottleneck. Mm-hmm. If we could only get these high pressures and temperatures, just 35,000 atmospheres at 1,000 degrees centigrade, that'd be easy. It would go. But at four times that pressure and temperatures up to seven times that high, it wouldn't go. It took this catalyst, which first one used was this troilite mineral, the same thing that was found as a skin around the microscopic diamonds in the meteorites.
Just as I'm curious, how long from the time you read about that until you tried it and it worked?
I couldn't give you an answer to that. I know that I had considered that possibility at the beginning. In fact, I recall seeing a note sometime in 1951 that ought to be an experiment to try. But there are so many things to try that and somehow I was looking more for how was it done in the pipe mines. And when all those schemes didn't work, finally your mind turns around sometimes and goes right back to the starting point. So I'm pretty sure it was of the order of 3 years from the time I had first thought that ought to be done till I finally did it.
Now, you mentioned that you developed the belt. Yeah, you were a chemist. How did you get involved in the...
I think that's a good question. Now, what's a chemist doing building a mechanical engineering?
Well, that's what all my associates and the boss and others thought. See, that was not my assignment. I was assigned strictly in the chemical area. You'd think that that's a job more for mechanical engineers and physicists. Well, I had a broad interest in that. I'd always had a broad interest in mechanical things, machine shops, as well as the other interests in physics, chemistry, electronics, and whatnot. So I, when the others weren't having success in their assignment, I was a patient and decided to try my own hand at it, even though it wasn't my assignment. This caused problems for me, but it finally worked out all right in the end.
How long did it take you to build the apparatus?
Well, I don't recall exactly, but from the time I had the idea and wanted to go ahead, there was a preliminary step, a thing we now call a half belt, that I had permission to build, but my associates felt that it wasn't a good device. It was, but I wasn't supposed to be dabbling in that area, and I believe that that sort of influenced their opinion. But it was no sooner built than I had an idea how to improve it into what we now call the full belt, or just a plain belt. And it's there where I hit the company bottleneck. They didn't want me to build it because they felt that the first idea, the half belt, wasn't any good. So I had to, as I think you read, do that sort of sub rosa. I just went to the machine shop and said, look, build this in your slack time. I knew the fellows real well, and they did. But it took considerable time. If that had been a crash program, you know, man, we got to get on this. This thing's liable to work. You could have put that out in the machine shop in 1 week's time. You could have had the apparatus, but it took many months. And then that was only built in steel, hardened steel. What we really need is titanium carbide, like this material here. It's very heavy, dense, viable stuff. We couldn't do that part in our shop there in Schenectady. That had to be done outside, so there's no way I could, you know, get that done sub rosa or by arm twisting or persuasion. Right. I had no authority to spend the couple of $1,000 that would have required for that stuff. But it took some persuading, but was finally accomplished. And when I got the tungsten carbide, then the thing was on its way. Pressures over 100,000 atmospheres were shortly achieved after obtaining the tungsten carbide parts to this device.
Dr. Hall, let me digress a moment, because one thing that intrigues me now, I don't know if this was a problem confronted by the bureaucracy of GE. I assume they have a bureaucracy like every other big organization.
Well, I don't know that bureaucracy is one of those words nowadays, you know. Mm-hmm. That's just natural human behavior that you meet up with everywhere. I wonder now, as I'm getting older, you know, if I suppress the younger men who work with me, like Dr. Cannon here, inhibit them, you know, because, well, I'm older, I've been through the mill, you know, and at least I try to avoid it, because I'm aware of it having happened to me when I was young, when those who were older and more experienced, so to speak, would think my ideas were not up to something, and perhaps just hadn't looked at it in the light they should have.
What I wanted to get at, a question that did intrigue me as I read the notes from your address, other than creating the synthesized diamonds, what else would the high-pressure apparatus that you designed, what other studies can be conducted using that particular apparatus?
Well, you could do all the science over again at high pressure.
I see.
Well, that's kind of an ambitious statement, but what it does mean is that, yes, you could do physics, geology, chemistry, many facets of engineering and mechanics. Many fields were immediately opened up. And actually, that's the thing that brought me to BYU. Having made diamond and having done it in such a short period of time that it was obvious it was a commercial thing. See, General Electric would have been satisfied just to have had the scientific achievement. We finally made diamonds after all these years when men had been trying to do it. But the diamonds grew in just a few seconds and in good yield, and you could see it would be an economic thing. So 2.5 years later, they were selling them. Now they make the material by the ton, and the volume of man-made material made throughout the world nowadays is about $100 million worth a year. Well, I was more of an idealist and purist, I think, from my training under Henry Eyring at the University of Utah. I was more practical than I realized after I got my PhD. I got it, you see, in theoretical chemistry, if you can imagine that one, as practical as I was. I'd go out and do plumbing and machining and everything else. But my idea was, they're just going to have to work all the details out of this. All the engineering has to come now, you know, to get this stuff on the market as cheap as possible. From now on, the research at GE is going to be diamond. And if I want to do chemistry or physics or anything else, I won't be able to do it. And that actually was true. And so when President Wilkinson and Dr. Harvey Fletcher contacted me to see if I wanted to come out here, they invited me to take either one of two jobs, Dean of the College of Physical Science and Engineering or Director of Research. Harvey Fletcher held both jobs. And that was too much for one man. They wanted to get someone else, and he'd take either one. They left me my choice. Well, thinking that the dean would be more administrative than the other, I took the director of research job. But my vision was getting into all the chemistry and physics and whatnot that now you could do with this high-pressure machine. But as you probably know, I became frustrated in that because of the secrecy order on this build apparatus that I had invented. But we invented this other device here, the tetrahedral enamel press, and you perhaps have heard some of the interesting things about that. But when this was developed, this became the first press available to the world that was described in the open scientific literature. And this brought hundreds of people to Brigham Young University to see how you do this. And I think you'd be interested to know that high-pressure research did not spread to the world from the General Electric Company. High-pressure, high-temperature research spread to the world from Brigham Young University. This is where it started, right here, BYU.
The device Dr. Hall has in his hands looks like nothing so much as a three-dimensional orbiting spaceship. that's probably a very poor layman's description of it.
No, that's what many people say. There have been some space things launched that look about like that, strangely enough. I think they copied us from it. They like the looks of it.
I'd like to pursue now for a moment the day that it happened, Dr. Hall. What was there anything out of the ordinary, or was it just a case of stopping the experiment to look to see what had happened, and bang, there it was? Can you recount somewhat what happened?
Well, yeah, of course, it's just one more experiment, you know, on and on. But I did have the troilite in, mineral iron sulfide. And it was the first experiment with that stuff, which is interesting. And, of course, there were all the variables, what pressure, what temperature, how long are you going to hold the time. Geologists said, you know, millions of years to grow a diamond in nature. Well, if it's going to take me that long, I won't see anything. But I had pressure and temperature in this device up to what I thought in those days was about 96,500 atmospheres. We know now that would have been somewhere around 70,000. Temperature was somewhere around 1,500 centigrade, and I had held those conditions for about 3.5 minutes. And then I lowered the temperature, and following lowering the temperature, I lowered the pressure. Oh, I forgot one important thing. The design of this belt was such that the graphite, which you hope to turn into diamond, was also the cell. The troilite was inside of a graphite tube. And I heated the thing by passing electric current through the graphite. See, graphite will conduct electricity like a metal. Not as well, but quite well. Diamond won't. Diamond is an insulator, electrical insulator. Well, I had an ammeter, which measures the current flow through the entire system, through this tube, and a voltmeter, which measured the voltage across it. And my traditional practice was to increase the voltage gradually once I was up to pressure, and then aim for some certain temperature. Well, I was just taking this up gradually, aiming for a temperature in the 1600 or 1700s. And I noticed the needle coming up on the ammeters. Both needles were coming up, voltmeter and ammeter coming up. And then as I kept turning up the voltage, the voltage kicked ahead a little fast, and the ammeter needle faltered. And then it started to go backwards. And the thought instantly struck me, say, if the graphite tube is turning into diamond, diamond's an electrical insulator, the electrical resistance is increasing, it's harder for the electrons to get through, so the current should fall. I'll stop and hold it right there, which was a smart move. Well, then after this, 3.5 minutes had gone by, I opened the thing up, let the pressure off, then opened the cell up. The cell, after a run, you knocked it out with a hammer and a steel pin, and it crumbled up a little bit. But then I could put it in my fingers and break it the rest of the way apart. And breaking it apart like that is a wintry morn, December 16th, 1954. And I saw little triangles. Now, these triangles are characteristic of diamonds, trigons, sometimes they call them. And the diamonds were big enough I could see them with my naked eye. Well, my hand just began to tremble like that. And my heart to palpitate. It would run so fast I couldn't stand it. And then it felt like it had stopped. And, of course, my emotions were beyond all imagination. It could never happen to you again to have such emotion all at once. My knees wouldn't hold me up. I had to sit down. But I knew that instant the diamonds had finally been made by man. Now, of course, you can't just go to the other scientists. They're always skeptics and say, hey, I've made diamonds. So I just kept it quiet for a couple of days. Repeated the experiment, made them again, and made all the tests I could, microscopic, hardness tests, chemical tests. They all said diamond. Now, there is a fingerprint in science known as the X-ray diffraction. Dr. Cannon here is an expert in that field. And if you got diamond and you take an X-ray diffraction picture, it'll clearly say it, just like the FBI's fingerprint says, that's you. And on Monday, I think this happened on a Thursday initially, the following Monday I had the X-ray diffraction pattern, which clearly said diamond, no doubt about it.
Well, how did you convince everybody finally that you'd really...
Well, they were all remained the scientific skeptics for a while, which is all right. I went 20 days making diamond without the other fellows getting particularly excited. Well, a couple of them were away. There's only one of them who was there. One was on vacation, and the other one had been assigned another project down in the GE Works, 2 or 3 miles away. Well, on the 31st of December, Hugh Woodbury, a physicist in the laboratory, under my direction, duplicated the experiment. So he became the second man to make diamonds. And then later on, the company, of course it caught on, they finally realized it really had been made. But to make sure, the company had attorneys come to Schenectady from the New York office and decide, how can we make this an ironclad situation? The reason for doing that, there had been lots of claims that people had made over 100 years that they had made diamonds. The problem usually was no one else could duplicate their claim. That's the important thing in science. If no one else can do it, then you say the other guy didn't do it. It's universally, if you give the recipe, so to speak, then others have got to be able to do it. Well, they decided that two men would be picked from the lab to run three experiments each according to my directions. That they would have to use different chemicals from a different bottle. That is, they couldn't use the stuff I'd been using. They had to go to the stockroom, get a new source of graphite, new source of iron troilite. And then I had to teach these fellows how to run my apparatus. Now, they chose Hugh Woodbury because I'd already had him do one, and he knew how. And then they picked another fellow who was a meddler just by the name of his Dr. Richard Oriani. And then I couldn't be there when they did the experiments. Well, this was worrisome. Couldn't watch. They didn't want me around. Now, I was not always successful myself. It's a borderline situation where didn't have perfect control of the variables in those days like we do now. Sometimes I make it, sometimes it wouldn't. But I was getting so I could make it at least 50% of the time. Well, fortunately, each man made three experiments, total of six, and diamonds were made in all six runs. Mm-hmm. So that convinced everybody, and that was recorded, you know, for future reference, witnessed by these attorneys and other people. Now, another reason Joe Electric did that is that they didn't want to reveal how they'd done it, but they wanted to, you know, sort of have it witnessed by responsible people who would say that it had been done without revealing how it had been done, mm-hmm. at least not in details. They named the belt apparatus and said it was high pressures and high temperatures, but not much more.
I see. Now, subsequent to that, Dr. Hall, there was some problem involving the invention of the high-pressure apparatus, the secrecy tangle. Could you briefly tell us some of the hassle involved in
that?
Well,
you got about a year's time. Well, it's hard to know how it came about, but the Department of Commerce became mixed up in this thing because of the filing of patents. Now, during World War II, there came to be some kind of a situation such that if you filed for a patent in the Commerce Department, which has the patent department under it, in examining patents, thought that this might be important to defense or war or whatnot, that they could make the patent secret. Now, the idea of the patent system in the first place is that you reveal how you did your invention. In return, the government gives you a 17-year monopoly on the use of that invention. After 17 years, then it becomes public property. The idea is that you reveal what you've done. In return, you get this length of protection. Now, the secrecy order would add to the length of protection. If the government puts a 7-year secrecy order on your invention, then you get 7 years of protection without revelation, so to speak, which can be good for a company under some respects, and other certain situations it may be bad. But anyway, in the field of atomic energy, neutrons and that kind of thing, after the war was over, there were laws passed that inventions there could still be subjected to this secrecy thing. But in general, inventions outside of the field of atomic energy were not subjected to the secrecy thing when the war was over. But they subjected the early patents on diamond synthesis and the patents on the belt apparatus. And by the way, the first patent of diamond synthesis is mine, and the first patent on high-pressure, high-temperature apparatus is mine. But of course, they're in my name in the patent office, but the General Electric Company owns them. Well, they put a secrecy order on those things, on the testimony, as I have the story of only one witness, which seems a strange thing to do, that we should keep this from the Iron Curtain countries and whatnot. I suppose maybe it's a good thing in some respects, but probably a bad thing in others. So they tell me that this is the first time in peacetime that an invention, there were at least two or three inventions in this case, all related, were subjected to this secrecy order outside the field of atomic energy. So if that can be claimed to be a unique privilege, I have that. Well, on wanting to use the belt apparatus out here for research in other areas.
Here at BYU.
Here at BYU, I thought, you know, I'll just bring this belt. And after I had made the decision to come here, the secrecy order came afterwards. So then I was confounded with the idea of not being able to use it. Now, the people where I had worked were not too eager to have me use it, and I suppose I can understand that. But then there was the secrecy order on top of it. So it's proprietary interest and a government secrecy order on the thing. I made several trips to Washington to try and find out how I could use this thing. And I would say to these people, look, I'm the father of this. I'm the inventor of it. And I can't even use my own device for other scientific things. I just want to explore chemistry and physics and geology. I'm not, diamonds you can have. And for years, I never touched diamonds. I just left it alone because I felt there's lots of scientific work to be done elsewhere. Well, I could never shake the thing loose, but finally, one of the fellows in the Department of Commerce says, Hall, I'll tell you what to do. He says, invent another apparatus. And, well, I didn't like that idea, and I immediately said to him, well, if I should invent another apparatus, wouldn't you put a secrecy order on that, too? What's the difference? Oh, no, no, we just want to keep what we already have in hand. But if you can invent another apparatus, you'll be free to use it. And immediately I said, give me a letter to that effect. And he says, oh, no, you don't need a letter. And so I went away without a letter, and then I invented this tetrahedral crest. There's more to the story. It takes money to build these things. Brigham Young University's entire research budget that was under my direction at that time wouldn't have been big enough to build the first working model of that. So the first people to come with money from outside, well, it was the Carnegie Foundation in Washington due to Dr. Philip Abelson, who had one time tried to hire me to go to work for the geophysical laboratory. See, they have a very high interest there in high pressure problems. Well, I went to see him over the secrecy order one time, and I came home with a $10,000 check from him. Now, I'd also been to see the National Science Foundation, but they were timid about giving me money. They wanted to, but they're aware of the secrecy order and perhaps General Electric proprietary interest that they may not have known whether I was telling them the truth or not. You never know. See, anyway, they worried about it. But when they learned that Carnegie was brave enough to give me $10,000, then they gave me $25,000. And it wasn't long until all branches of government were out here offering us money. We could have had millions of dollars in the early days here, 1955, 56, 57, but I couldn't use it. I had a full-time administrative job, and we were short on shop, our scientific apparatus and facilities and whatnot was just minor here at BYU in those days. And I couldn't use that kind of money, so I had to turn it down. But I kept enough to do what we could do. Well, we came up on working with four or five devices on which I had ideas. I built them all at the same time. I'd already lost some time. I was getting up to be a year and a half or so of time, which when you're young seems like it's forever. But I had all these devices built. I had to build a lot of them myself because I thought they were related to the belt, and I didn't want to get in jail and have $10,000 fine or whatever it was. Well, this tetrahedral press proved to be the machine. It was the one that worked. So when I found out it worked, I went back to Commerce and said, well, now look, I've invented that new machine you told me to invent. Now I want you to tell me, is it okay to go ahead and use this? Well, he says, the test is in the patent. If you file patents on it, you know, and it's separately patentable from your former devices with the General Electric Company, then you'll be in the clear. Well, all high-pressure machines work the same in that they push on something, so what's going to be different, you know? Well, there are differences. Oh, yeah. There are subtle differences, of course. But they said the responsibility's on your shoulders. You're the only guy that's in a position to make the decision. And I says, what? You mean I have to take the responsibility if I publish this, file for a patent, et cetera, and people come and see it. They'd already been here to see it by then. As to whether or not I pay this fine and go to jail for revealing U.S. government secrets and whatnot, which happened also to be my secrets in a way, you know, I'm the inventor of it. They said, it's all on your shoulders. Well, I have never had more trouble with wondering whether I'm going to have ulcers or a heart attack or just miserable from worry, you know, what to do. But finally, I came to peace with myself. This is separately patentable. I'd been involved with patents for a number of years and knew some of the legalities of the thing, and I clearly came in my own conscience, this is separately patentable, and it's clear. So I made the decision to speak about it at an American Chemical Society meeting, I believe it was the spring of 1968, I believe it was San Francisco. And I mailed off the written document, the publication, completely describing it to the Review of Scientific Instruments, and I filled out the patent disclosure and sent it off to the Patent Department through Research Corporation, which manages patents, or used to at least, for Brigham Young University. And I scheduled all these things to happen at about the same time so that it would be published about the same time, and the patent department would have it, and I'd give the paper in San Francisco. Well, I had a standing room audience only at San Francisco. My GE friends were there to see what beans I might spill, you know. And all the people who had ever had an interest in high pressure had come to see, how's this guy say you can do this, you know, outside of the belt apparatus, which everyone had heard about, but which was not disclosed. Well, everything went well. It was published in the 60,000 copies worldwide of the Review of Scientific Instruments went out. I think this was April. And then in August, in the mail at my home, came a letter, and up in the corner I read U.S. Department of Commerce. Well, my heart just sank because I had no idea what was in the letter. Sure enough, it was a letter making this tetrahedral device a U.S. government secret. Well, what am I going to do? You know, it's already disclosed. Been over 100 people come to BYU to see it. 150, as I remember. Maybe it was 180. And disclosed all over the world. Well, the Commerce people told me to write to everybody. I had several trips to Washington and this, that, and the other. And told me I had to write a letter to everybody and tell them this was now a U.S. government secret. And I says, what, even the foreign scientists? Yeah, you got to write to everybody. Got to write to the people who read the Review of Scientific Instruments? Yeah, I got to write to them. Well, finally, I went to my friend Philip Abelson again, and he got things calmed down a bit. And finally, the government people decided that I only had to write to those people who had been to Provo and seen the machine and tell them there's a government secret. Well, I felt foolish about the whole thing, but it's what they required. Furthermore, they told me that here at BYU now, we'd have to lock it up, you know, post a guard, and have all the secrecy associated with secret documents here at BYU. Well, I saw no way of doing that, and I explained, I can't do that. It's going to cost us money. I don't have hardly space to do the experiments as it is, let alone, you know, get some money to now lock this up so nobody can see it. Well, my friend Philip Abelson and others, including the Patent People Research Corporation, kept hammering away, and in 6 months they got the government to change their mind and relinquish the secrecy on this, and at the same time they decided to relinquish the secrecy on the belt apparatus and this diamond synthesis. But the General Electric people wanted another 6 months time, and it was granted. So secrecy came off on this immediately. I think it was August of 68. By 1960, the General Electric secrecy came off and the government secrecy came off, and the belt apparatus details and diamond synthesis were set free in 1960.
Quite a hassle. And the thing that amazes me is that you know, that you would continue to persist.
Well, I'm telling you, many times I thought of giving up, just throw it all over. What the heck? I'll just be an administrator and give up science. Well, I seem to be wedded to the bench, as scientists often say. Scientists often have this dilemma. Am I going to administrate? I'm going to be a bench scientist? Or am I going to try and do the two together? I spent 12 years as the director of research here, and after 7 years, I was talking to my superiors about, you know, let me out of this job. By the time 12 years has gone by, I finally convinced them to let me return to where I could do more research. Because as the research program built at BYU, the paperwork and administrative responsibilities were getting such that it was almost impossible to get anything done. I used to come over here. Those first 12 years of my life, I'm sure I worked 78 hours a week. I'd come over here 4 o'clock in the morning lots of time, try and get in 6 hours before 10 o'clock before I'd have to do my paperwork, you know, for the day to try and get some high pressure research done. We managed pretty well. I was young enough to stand it then. I can't do it anymore.
Do you get much chance to be a bench scientist, as you say now?
Well, I don't know. Things keep happening to you as you get older that deter you from it. Dr. Cannon and others find themselves doing most of the high pressure research these days.
Do you see an attitude, has an attitude changed? Now, we hear a lot about academic freedom, Dr. Hall, and of course, your hassle with the government on the secrecy certainly has to be a classic example of interference with academic freedom, I think. Do you feel that this type of thing tends to inhibit science? Do you think there could be more be done if somehow there was a freer attitude on this?
Well, I have mixed feelings on that. You see, there'd never been a tetrahedral anvil press if there hadn't been the obstacle. It's a better machine than the Belt apparatus. So sometimes obstacles, you know, there you'll find determined people among the humanity somewhere, and necessity in this case led to a better invention. We might still be using the Belt apparatus if it hadn't been for that. So who's to say? I don't know. It may work both ways. At the time, it was miserable, but as I look back on it, you know, it makes a good story now. So, and maybe it was beneficial. Who knows? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I am sure that no matter how, I don't hold any ill feelings against any of these people, you know. I don't think I ever have, really. But I think that's part of life. We're going to have obstacles. If there aren't going to be, if they remove those somehow inadvertently, maybe on purpose sometimes, but maybe just inadvertently most of the times because of our human natures and the way things are, they're just going to be obstacles. And we've just got to teach our young people to be determined, keep moving in spite of the obstacles. And it might be a thing that makes you grow. It may be a good thing.
Yeah, sometimes it's the obstacle that spurs you on, perhaps. I've been talking with Dr. Tracy Hall, Dr. John Cannon here of the faculty in chemistry and in science in general, I think, really, on the campus at BYU. Okay, thank you.
Where's Amber?
Earl, I was using his ass's crammers and shower with leashes. And I even said, no. But, Earl Fred said the night's mucking choke. Like some nurse in the nurses and his all keep him sin. But he was dark with the wine who was self stump by Eve to me, said so. And the shower with the end was very the. And I got a girl to water, get girls knocking her chest, but did that thing all, did that say he died. No less than a merc boost, said the little kid. Her fat serious. He looked at the amulet with the mouse doing that, dang it. Plus, there will now for this meat eel spare for slice, and then we were going to get it alive in the spare for states that I need to chase and if not carry the deal, yum, did it, and it's good that no, I get killed for not, no, I did that. See, when Rowan was chose this, that I'll wait, does he? See, them in the ball, and if they were sweet, dark, if they're mad, full of raw, and they even all did it, what? So if they're in the sea, if he sees the beef, but that crap's gay, then they even the fall. The hiller when in the yeller and I should say guys it isn't you were having a wooden eye in the sea and stiff as a ground but I would cross the woods this year and cross it. But
there's nothing about it.
Now the prayer has been funded and helped me fit and I did it with me
and then it's